When the war ended in 1945, Turing was eager to go further. On one of his last days at Bletchley, as he and Joan filed away their hyper-classified work, Turing told her that he'd persuaded the National Physical Laboratory, NPL, outside London to give him a team so that he could finally build the infinitely changeable machine he sought. He and Joan had broken up. On calm reflection, she decided marriage to a gay man would not be the wisest of choices, but this was a moment to share confidences. At first, it went well. The head of the NPL was Sir Charles Darwin, grandson of the great biologist and one of the best-connected science administrators in the country. What Turing didn't realize at first, though he learned fast, was that although Darwin had been a useful scientist as a young man, and indeed had helped Rutherford with the original solar system model of the atom, he was now a harumphing, pipe-smoking grandee. Darwin seemed to feel that if this odd fellow Turing wanted to build a practical machine, or even a number of practical machines, that was fine. After all, post-war Britain needed such help. But why was he going on about this universal machine? And what were all those musings he heard Turing blurt out? It had been difficult keeping him away from journalists, about a computer that could someday write a sonata, or be given mechanical legs and navigate the countryside, or be programmed to learn anything one could imagine. How could one possibly build a machine by, expressly, not building a particular machine at all? There were rumors that Turing had done something very important in the war, but to Darwin, he clearly seemed off the rails. Turing was exasperated. The only way to get a computer to operate, he knew, was to create a physical machine that was quite simple, with an arrangement of hardware inside so pliable that one could devote one's efforts to coming up with ingenious programming that would change how the electrical signals inside were shuttled around. There was no need to build the physical machine afresh each time. His fellow workers had come close to this design with the wartime Colossus, in their efforts to keep up with the constantly changing arrangements inside the Germans' coding machines. At Bletchley, there hadn't been enough time to do more. Why wouldn't anyone let him go further now? As 1946 turned into 1947, Turing made hardly any progress. Darwin and the other administrators became suspicious. Turing looked for other jobs. In the autumn of 1948, Turing moved to Manchester, where word had it that something closer to a true computer was being built. There were competing projects in the UK now, for a number of researchers had picked up on Turing's pre-war papers or on American wartime work similar to the still-classified Colossus machine. All the teams wanted to take this research further. But if London and Princeton had been difficult for Turing, Manchester was impossible. The mathematicians designing the device were friendly enough, but they had already started on their own blueprints, which weren't even as bold as Turing's original 1937 vision. In fact, there was a new technology being perfected in America that could have transformed his life, one that involved harnessing the newfound properties of electrons in the submicroscopic quantum realm. Turing had even heard enticing rumors of these devices. He dawdled for most of 1949, trying one subject after another. At one point, he considered trailing back to Cambridge, but becoming an academic seemed petty after all he had done. He tried some of his old topics in pure mathematics, but he was getting too old for that as well. Von Neumann wrote him a cheery note from Princeton. "Dear Alan, what are the problems on which you are working now, and what is your program for the immediate future?" But Turing had little to answer. He was alone, perhaps more so than ever before. His mother continued to write him regularly, apologetically asking about his progress in finding a wife. It was getting harder to write back with the conventional lies. His love life was meager, and perhaps in memory of the cold showers from prep school days, Turing had taken up long-distance running, and was at one point ranked as one of the leading marathon runners in Britain. His best time was within 17 minutes of the then-current Olympic record. He would have been considered for the British Olympic team, but for an unexpected hip injury. Instead of real love, he was resigned to occasional casual pickups. They were of no great significance until, one evening in January 1952, Turing realized that a young laborer who had stayed over must have passed information about his house to an accomplice, for when Turing arrived home, he saw he'd been robbed. He went to the police to complain, probably more hurt by the breach of faith than by the cash value of what was taken. It was a terrible mistake. Homosexuality was a crime in Britain then. The accomplice was arrested, immediately implicated Turing in exchange for immunity, of course, and Turing was seized. He was soon in court, alone, for what was then considered a very serious crime. Because of his wartime service, the award from the British government hints that he might be selected for a knighthood, it was arranged that he could avoid prison. But this meant agreeing to undergo experimental treatment to cure his homosexuality. The treatment was mandatory consumption of female hormones. There was little alternative to accepting. Prison would have been brutal, and only at a university could Turing continue his work. Turing began the course of pills, picking them up at regular intervals as required. At first, he thought the effects would be insignificant, but the treatment made it hard to concentrate. Even if he had tried to get the dosages lowered, the judge was implacable and wouldn't have allowed it. And then, as the hormone treatment went on, Turing found to his horror that he was developing breasts. It was too much. He had no intellectual companions, he had no chance of love, and now his body and mind were being destroyed. The treatment stopped in April 1953, but he never really recovered. One rainy June evening in 1954, Turing was at his home in the Manchester suburb of Wilmslow. He took out an apple, and then he opened a jar of potassium cyanide that he kept for gold plating reactions in his electrical experiments. The jar still had some cyanide inside when it was examined the next day. The apple, found beside his body, was missing several bites.